Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
You may have been watching what's been happening in Kenya. We've been speaking about Kenya, in fact, for some weeks now, and it doesn't seem to be letting up. The protests continue to be facing themselves up against quite a brutal police force. The protests are not letting up, and Professor Gilbert Kadiakala is an international relations analyst on the line with us. Thanks, Prof, for making time for us. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you. How are you doing?
We are well, but things aren't looking very good in Kenya, Prof. You know, it's been coming over a couple of weeks, and at some point we thought everything was going to calm down. The president said, no, look, I'm dissolving cabinet. I'm going to do some changes. I'm remorseful for those who've lost their lives, but we're here again.
Yeah, we're here again because the kinds of quote-unquote reforms that Mr. Ruto embarked upon were perceived by the protesters as too little and too late. He changed the cabinet. He withdrew the financial bill, which was a big bone of contention, and that was good. But the problem also was one of governance. So he withdrew or he sacked his cabinet. But then within a week, he also reappointed half of that cabinet back into office. And he's planning, I think, tomorrow or late this week to reappoint another group of cabinet ministers who people believe are also just going to come from the old cabinet. So he's not addressed the basic grievances that drive these protests, which are issues around the economy, the mismanagement of the economy, issues around corruption, issues around an elite that is very insular. They live very good lives. They go for holidays in Dubai. But the people are really, really in trouble economically, and the standards of living, the high cost of living is the main driver. And the issue of joblessness for the youth, who are like 60% unemployed, so it's a bad, bad problem that Mr. Ruto has been confronting. And I don't know how he's going to manage that, but it's very difficult.
Will he have room to still gain some sort of, you know, I suppose, trust with the community? He did say he was remorseful for those who've lost their lives, but when you look at the conduct of the police, none of that has changed. You still see quite a brutal force.
No, you know, the problem with him is that he's not honest about what his decisions are going to be. He speaks from both sides of his mouth. I think he was very remorseful at the beginning. But then just last Sunday, he was now talking about, you know, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. We're going to deal with these people. Mm-hmm. We invited them to negotiations. They refused. And so he was, you know, blustering quite all over the place. And these young people don't really like him because they don't believe him. They don't really believe him. Mm-hmm. And he's got a record of not really saying the truth. So that's the big crisis, yeah. I think the other point...
Go ahead, sir.
No, the other point I was going to make is that, you know, they have said that he's a weak president. Mm. And he's weak enough so that he can only rely on the military and the police. Mm. And they see that, in fact, if they continue to push, he may actually have to leave power. And that's their objective now. They are saying he has to go.
I was going to go ask you that they've already said it. They've called it. They've said, no, he now needs to step down. Will he step down, do you think?
No, I don't think he's going to step down. I think the history tells us that he's going to hang on. He's going to be tough. He has no history of accommodating what other people are saying, because he was vice president for 10 years, and before that he was in other big positions. So he's known as a very tough guy, if we could put it that way. And he sees the chance that I think the youth are trying to spoil his game, which is that he wants to run things the way he wants to run them.
Well, I mean, ultimately, even if he remains sturdy and he will not step down easily, at some point, he's going to have to buckle to some pressure. Yes, maybe he doesn't quite like what his citizens have to say, but he's probably going to have to buckle to international pressure, because that probably is going to be coming. At some point, it's going to affect other businesses that are not necessarily local.
You see, the problem is that the economy is in dire straits. And the IMF has been really pushing him. In fact, part of the problem was created by the IMF, because it was telling him, you know, to broaden the austerity measures that would allow the government now to begin to repay the huge $40 billion debt that it has. So that pressure is still there. He hasn't resolved that issue. In fact, there's more pressure on him because the finance bill was withdrawn, and therefore he has really to work very hard around this budget to meet the expenses for this year, next year, but also to pay the debt. So the IMF is going to come back. In fact, I read a report today. They're already knocking on his door and saying, you know, so what is the game plan on debt repayment? Mm. And so it's very difficult for him to deal with those dual pressures from abroad and from home. I think what he's trying to do at home is to try to pull in some of the opposition people so that they can, in fact, decrease the pressure from the young people. But, you know, some of the opposition people are not interested in helping him out of this crisis. And the youth are determined not to listen even to the opposition because they are saying, you're the same generation. Mm. You tell the same lies. You're all corrupt. So I don't see how that strategy is actually going to work at this point. So we just need to wait and see who is actually going to blink first. Is it the young people or is it Mr. Ruto?
Well, it can't go on forever. You've watched this playing itself out. What's your prediction?
My prediction is that I think he'll be forced to make more bigger concessions than he has done so far. I think the reappointment of the same individuals to cabinet was a big mistake. And if he can actually work towards really resolving the crisis of who is now going to be in his cabinet, maybe that will relieve some of the pressure. But if he doesn't, and he's increasingly now relying on the military, and it's not a good sign for a military that has always been in the barracks. Now it's been on the street almost for 2 weeks. So it's not a good sign for the country as a whole. But the youth don't have much to lose, because they are saying we are jobless. You know, we can protest every day if we want. We have nothing to lose
anyway.
So it's a
jobs.
Very difficult situation. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult situation because there are no jobs. One would have argued, you know, maybe there could be a mediator from the region or whatever. But you saw today, in fact, a big protest also in Uganda. The youth in Uganda raising the same issues of corruption and so on.
I was going to ask you that it does seem like, you know, you are starting to get a groundswell now of young people who are saying enough is enough in that region.
Yeah, the region is on fire because the grievances that are driving the protests are the same everywhere. Joblessness, hopelessness, and then the corruption of the elite, mismanagement of resources. In Uganda, the difference is that it's a heavily militaristic state. So when they went to the street, they actually didn't make much of a difference, because the police and the military was all over the city. In Kenya, at least, they have some room. In fact, there are stories today, or there are videos of the military, you know, talking to the youth, and the people are actually beginning to like the military because they think they behave better than the police.
They actually have. So let's talk about Museveni in Uganda, who in fact warned them. They were always saying that they're going to have a protest today, and he said, listen, you know, you try me. You're playing with fire. And as you said, not quite successful, but that it is a groundswell of something that I feel is going to happen. You know how they've treated the opposition. Bobby Wine has had a really difficult time with them. And as you said, you know, this is not a man who's going to play games. I'm afraid. Let me just put it that way.
No, he's not going to play games on it short today. But what I like about what the Ugandans did is that at least they made an effort. They were on the street. Quite a few are arrested.
Yeah.
So it's a good sign that, in fact, the momentum for the youth to lead, to provide a kind of leadership on corruption and, you know, change is important. Even if they are arrested and they go to jail, I think Museveni has had a record of not tolerating any of these activities. In fact, if it were the old Museveni, there would be more people dead in Uganda today. But fortunately, I haven't seen any reports of anybody dead, but there are quite a number who are in prison quite a number who are injured. So it's a good sign that, in fact, they went to the streets and they did make the point that they want to invade parliament, even if they knew realistically they can't do it because of the nature of the regime.
I mean, we say this and we say, you know, Museveni is ruthless and they're not going to get away with much. But you make the point, you know, at least they attempted to do something. And we can see there is some copycat kind of way in which they're conducting themselves to what they've seen in Kenya. Are you getting the sense that we are probably going to see a bigger sort of swell around the region beyond even Uganda?
Tanzania is also, the trade unions are trying to organize, I think, some protests. They have been talking about that for the last 2 weeks since the Kenyan violence began, the protests began. But they haven't been able to organize as effectively to get the masses onto the streets. And the youth movement in Tanzania is also relatively quiet. Mm. And I can't understand why, but the trade unions are trying to come up and begin to lead. And Tanzania is equally a difficult state when it comes to anyway democratization, because the one party has been in power pretty much since independence, and they have a very strong state machinery that can always preempt the protest. But I'm saying that I think the opportunities in Uganda and Kenya in particular are also going to embolden the people. You remember that this protest started in 2011 in Tunisia and into Egypt and Libya.
Yes.
But they didn't go as much further south as we thought they would.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point I was saying, you know, there are many candidates like Tunisia who should be, many regimes like Tunisia in Africa that should be toppled.
Mm.
But it took quite a while to get to places like Kenya, where everybody, you know, everybody thought Kenya would just make it, because once you have a fairly open system, you have a free media, a fairly free, and then you have regular elections and so on. But the institutions are still very rotten. Because the elites don't really even want really, really free elections. So the youth now, I think, are picking up the mantle of the old leadership of the opposition, and they're saying, we are going to do it now, so we don't want anybody else to lead this movement. So that's the biggest change, I think.
And of course, now they have access to social media. They're able to see from other parts
Precisely.
Of the world where things are
Precisely,
happening.
Precisely, I was also going to say, in fact, the difference between Uganda and Kenya is that in Kenya, they actually just mobilized on social media before they went to the streets.
Yeah.
Ugandans, they announced it 2 weeks ago that they were going to...
Well, and this is the problem. I mean, I knew the minute you say last week or the week before that we're going to be going on Tuesday, he has all the time in the world to actually prevent
from
going. So, but it was an attempt nonetheless that we shouldn't scoff at. I quickly want to
address...
No,
it's a good attempt.
Yes.
Good attempt, yes.
I quickly want to address, unfortunately, what we are seeing happening in Ethiopia as this story develops. Now we are sitting 229 people having been killed by the landslides.
No, I haven't seen any recent report on Ethiopia, but I know that Ethiopia has had very big internal problems, particularly after the war, the internal war with the Tigray, and that war hasn't actually ended. And there have been a lot of reports around the military, Ethiopian military leading massacres against civilians in Tigray, who are still not really happy that there was an agreement, and this agreement is not being implemented fully. So that is still bubbling. And then, of course, you have the other regions like Amhara, not very happy about the regime. So I would not be surprised that things are also just breaking out there, because that conflict is not as well known. Even though it was signed here about 2 years ago. But the problem is that the government wants to dictate the pace of the implementation. It means that they don't want, in fact, to address the basic grievances of the Tigrayans, who don't feel like the federalism in Ethiopia is as steady as it should be. It doesn't give them as much as it should. So that conflict is still very much up in the air, and we'll have to see how that works out.
And how do you think, as I was saying earlier, how do you think, you know, climate change, what we're seeing, which are natural disasters, how are they going to affect what's happening in that region, as you're saying, that Tigray war, I mean, that it has been going for a while now. You know, the effects of what will be happening environmentally to wars that are ongoing?
You know, the wars of the future, the wars are emerging from climate change. Whether it's a question of refugees moving and impinging on other people, climate change has a real, real serious impact on the future world. Whether it's an issue around water, the water resources, and other natural resources that are affected by climate change, this is a big issue on the horizon. But that's why everybody's talking about, you know, how do we deal with the so-called just energy transition mitigation measures and so on? Because it's very clear already that some of these conflicts, particularly in places like the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Somalia, northern Kenya, Sudan, these are places where there are very vulnerable communities living on very hostile natural environment. Mm. So, you know, conflict over pasture, there's no water, there are no rains, and you even in Southern Africa now, there's a huge drought in places like Zambia and Zimbabwe. Mm. And these droughts are going to lead to migration, which are going to lead to conflict on the world. So it's a very dangerous, we are living in very dangerous times, and especially climate change, since the resources to deal with climate change are enormous. And it's very frightening.
I really appreciate your take on all of this, Professor Gilbert Kadiakala, who is an international relations analyst. I hope we'll speak soon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show, folks. We'll be back tomorrow, Eddie. Thanks, everybody.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.